Time to take a look at your automobile here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, it's a pretty nasty surprise when you get into your vehicle on a hot day and the AC doesn't work. And we're going to talk about some preventive measures you can take to lessen your chances of that happening. Again, I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Ward in the studio with me today. He's the service manager at Smart Motors. Over 10 years of master certification, and he stops by a few times a year to help you with your vehicle questions. And I hope you'll join in. Give us a call, the number 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And Jim Ward, welcome back. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you, Larry. Glad to be here.
Well, we hear a lot about winterizing, but, you know, I think most people do that, but summerizing, is that another good way to put it?
Well, let's summarize. Yeah. Winterizing or summerizing really sometimes I worry about people thinking that the extreme weathers are the only time that they really have to worry about a car. I mean, frankly, honestly, if you follow your manufacturer's maintenance guidelines, you really probably don't need to do anything special otherwise. But if you buy a secondhand car, buy a used car, and you don't necessarily know what the history's been, particularly going into those severe weather seasons, you want to make sure that everything is in shape, that the cooling system's going to be able to keep the car cool and the air conditioning system's going to be able to keep you cool, or the heater in the wintertime, as it were. You know, it can be a safety issue as well as just convenience and having things work the way you want to.
There's some obvious, I guess, you know, ways to tell your AC isn't working, but maybe sometimes there are other things that, you know, if you're not getting any cool air, you know, it's not working or may not be working. But how do you tell if your AC is working the way it should work?
Well, there are a number of different types of problems we see with air conditioning systems, and certainly the one that is going to get your attention the quickest is going to be lack of cooling. If you're not getting any cold air out of there, that's real obvious too. Air conditioning systems usually, if they develop a leak, it isn't a gross leak. In other words, everything doesn't leak out. More often than not, it's going to be a very slow leak that probably only leaks under special circumstances, but eventually it'll leak enough down that the system starts to work marginally, and probably will still cool, but not nearly as well as it used to. So that's what a lot of people report, is that I'm getting some cooling. Some air conditioner systems have little quirks where you'd think something completely different was going on, but just because of the way some of them are laid out, when it's a little bit low on Freon, one side will work and the other won't. You have air conditioning coming out the passenger side vents and not the driver's side, which doesn't make a lot of sense, but that's how they really work, and it's a little bit engineered that way. But some less common air conditioning problems are that your air conditioner works primarily by condensing moisture out of the air, and it condenses a lot of moisture out of the air. If you watch on a hot, humid day, cars are running, and you're going to see water running out of about a finger-sized diameter hose that's usually coming out usually about the middle of the dash, or a little bit more toward the passenger front wheel, and it's not unusual at all. Sitting at a stoplight, a car will dump a pint to a quart of water out just sitting there in that little brief period of time. So a lot of water is produced, and those hoses are prone to getting plugged with different things. This year and last year, it seems more common, we get these really hard rains. Of course, you have to park under trees. That loosens a lot of stuff up, not just leaves, but seed debris. And if you have pine trees and some of the trees with the finer
needles,
and needles and stuff like that, they eventually can work their way down. They come in where the air intake comes in, and they get washed down to that little, there's a drain pan, there's a little plastic drain pan underneath the air conditioner unit in the dash, and that water should ideally just drain out of there. But if that starts to get plugged up, the water builds up. If that little unit in the dash in that pan is underwater, it doesn't cool very well. And, you know, so people will notice some loss of cooling, but they usually come in saying, you know, it's strange, but when I turn right, I get a teaspoon or two of water on my driver's foot, splashes out because that pan is overflowing on a turn. So, and insect intrusion is another thing we don't see as much here, but down south, that's a really big problem, to the point where most manufacturers have actually come up with a little permethrin block at the bottom of that drain hose. But that system getting plugged up can be a problem. And because of just having to deal with all that condensation and humidity, one of the most common problems is that it cools, but it stinks. It's got this mildew odor to it. And those things can be addressed, too. It's an environmental thing. There's more pollen and particulates in the air than ever. I mean, you know, it may not be like smog pollution, but that's all that moisture has to have to stick to walls and start to form some mold and mildew. And there are treatments that can be done to basically sanitize that system. And most cars now have a pollen filter in them, and those can be replaced with a charcoal activated one, which really helps, you know, between flushing out that evaporative drain system and putting in a charcoal activated cabin filter. You can get rid of the odor problem, but that's one of the more common problems we see on them as well now. So.
You know, I drove to St. Louis from Madison on the 4th of July, kind of just ahead of the 4th of July, to see my daughter march in her band in St. Louis. But along the way, I saw two cars off to the side, hood up. You know darn well they're overheating.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that kind of overheating, I mean, a component can suddenly fail in a cooling system, but awful lot of the time, the majority of the time, there's probably an indication that there was a leak, that, you know, they probably started out their trip a little low on antifreeze in the radiator, and a radiator can have a side seam leak. You know, a water pump may leak. You might have a hose clamp even that starts to leak a little bit. But, of course, it's going to be on a really hot day. The pressures in the cooling system go up, and a leak that kind of maintained and just seeped a little bit out and a little bit out, but everything was still performing okay. On a really hot day, on a long highway trip, the pressures climb, and they climb, and they climb, to suddenly that little leak's not a little leak anymore, and a lot of antifreeze comes out, and you're stuck and stranded. And that's a reason, you know, before going on a long trip, particularly this time of year, but you have to, the older the vehicle, the more important it is to have that cooling system checked out and just to take a look and make sure, you know, it may not have lost very much up to the departure of your trip, but at that point, hot weather, and 4th of July weekend, was a real hot week, as I recall.
It was warm in St. Louis, I can tell you that for sure. Oh, man. Jim Ward, our guest today, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. Great to have him along. If you have a question about maintenance on your car, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Well, let's take some calls. Dennis and DePier just joins us, so let's go there. Hi, Dennis. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question about an older vehicle with 200,000 miles on. I've been told that when you get a vehicle like that, not to flush the transmission fluid, because it's run that long without a flush, not to mess with it. And the other is go ahead and do it right away. What is there any truth to either of those?
What kind of car do you have, by the way?
It's a Toyota Camry.
Toyota Camry, okay.
And how old is this older Camry?
2005 with 230,000
okay.
miles.
Well, you know, the transmission fluid in that is a fluid that does have a change interval to be done. That concern about flushing it and having something, you know, be flushed into a passage somewhere and blocking it is not really a scenario that we see play out very often, but it does happen now and then. It can be a concern. You know, part of what we look at here is that, A, there's a manufacturer schedule for changing that fluid, and you could look at that schedule, but and see if it's probably recommended at a certain interval, something like 60,000 miles, and if you tow with the vehicle, if you have a trailer hitch on it and tow, then they usually have an advanced, a little, you know, more frequent schedule to change it. But the fluid itself can be evaluated. It ultimately, if the car has never towed and if you've never gotten stuck, I mean, in the wintertime, if you get stuck and you have to go reverse drive back and forth and get yourself out of the ditch, you can heat up that fluid and kind of burn it, and it tends to get a kind of a bad burnt clay odor to it. So someone could certainly take a look at the fluid and see how it appears and see if it has a burnt odor. If the transmission's functioning properly on a car with that kind of mileage and you're not having any problems and the fluid looks good, you know, I don't think I myself would get all that excited about flushing that fluid out if you're not having any symptoms and it doesn't look and smell burnt.
There we go. Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Annie in La Crosse next. Hi, Annie. Thank you for calling.
Hey, this is a great day for me to call. I have a Chevy Astro. It's a 2004. It only has 97,000 miles on it, and I do tow a trailer with it, but that's beside the point. I was told the air conditioning system hasn't been working for a couple years. When I had it looked at by my local service people, who I trust, they said in order to get at the problem, they have to rip the whole dashboard out, and it would cost $800 just to replace this little part that's under there. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about, and is there any way to fix it?
Well, they're probably talking about an expansion valve. The air conditioning has got a device like a radiator out under the hood, and a device that's like a heater core. Like, it's very similar to how the heating system works in a vehicle. The heater core is in the dash for the heater, and the evaporator is what they call it, that's in the dash for the air conditioner. And they're both essentially like little radiators that the gas flows through, and it you know, basically takes moisture out of the air, and that helps take the heat out of the air. The refrigerant in an air conditioner system has to change forms from gas to liquid, and it does that through a real small orifice, and the one at the evaporator in the dash is called an expansion valve, and that is probably what they're talking about, and there really aren't shortcuts to get at it and to be able to replace it. I mean, it you know, different air conditioning systems and different vehicles are some more accessible than others, but unfortunately that's a part that's really not very accessible. It is a big job to get at that, to take it out and replace it.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Wish I had some better easy news for you. Yeah,
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too. Give a call, 1-800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. If a vehicle maintenance question or maybe an experience to share, I'd love to hear it. 800-642-1234. What about batteries here before we take some more calls and so forth? We always worry about it in the winter.
And in fact, right, it's just as hard on a battery when we have extremely hot weather. They start to fail in fact, the really hot weather like they've had down in Arizona and in the southwestern part of the country, you know, getting 110, 120 degrees every day is actually harder on a battery than when we get 20, 30 below for several days. The bad thing in winter is that the only thing that keeps that liquid in the battery from freezing is having that electrical charge. That chemical activity keeps it from freezing. And so the problem here in Wisconsin is if battery discharges, even if the battery itself isn't the problem, you leave lights on in the wintertime, that battery is probably going to freeze and may not recover and probably won't be able to recharge. In the summer, it's a different set of conditions, but they are equally hard on batteries. And fortunately, there are tests that are usually able to predict a battery's demise before you start to have symptoms. So, and most of the time, any place that you even have your regular oil change and tire rotation, minor maintenance done, probably is doing a multi-point inspection, and that generally includes a battery test. So, it isn't that people never have batteries fail, a surprise. It still happens. There's different things that go wrong with them, and it can be sudden and not have been caught on a test. But far more often than used to be, we catch the battery before that click, click, click day comes and get it replaced before you actually get stranded.
I had a question about that. You know, I don't know what I was doing, but I accidentally turned the little knob on my Highlander lever that instead of the lights turning off automatically 20 seconds afterwards, you know, I got in the garage, I shut the garage door, and the light stayed on. And of course, I get up there in the morning to go to work, and the battery's dead. My neighbor has a nice charging system that he brought over, plugged it in and charged it, and I haven't had a bit of trouble with it since.
Yep. I mean, a battery is perfectly capable of being discharged down to the point where it won't start the car and charge back up over and over again. Again, the winter and freezing is the biggest concern, because if that battery's outside and real cold, it can freeze, but it's certainly capable of being recharged. It's funny how the light switches on different cars. A lot of cars have automatic headlights, and they'll have an auto setting on the switch, but there are plenty of cars that actually do have auto function that don't say auto on them, even though leaving them in on position, they'll shut off. So it's important to be familiar with those switch positions on your car, because you're used to walking away and seeing the lights on, they're going to shut off in 30 seconds, but what happens that day when they don't.
Well, I didn't think I'd damaged the battery because the car, I mean, that's been a year and it's running just fine. Dennis in Nisida, let's go to you. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I got a partial system of a R12 system in my 78 Chevy, and I was wanting to put the 134 in it and wondering what all do I need to replace?
Well, typically there are conversion kits made. They're going to have a different set of seals because the seals are not compatible between those two systems. The R134A will deteriorate the seals in the R12 system.
What are we talking about here, by the way?
Well, what we typically refer to as Freon is the gas that R12 was a traditional original coolant that had been in cars up. Oh, I couldn't tell you what year it had to change to R134A, but R12, if it escapes from the system, is harder on the ozone layer. It eats it up. R134A is a much friendlier. They're both greenhouse gas concerns, but it's a much lesser greenhouse gas. But they're not compatible systems. The same machine you'd use to charge and discharge them, the O-rings in the system, often that expansion valve we were talking about in the other vehicle, sometimes even a condenser receiver dryer has to be replaced. And one of the things that was kind of disappointing when we started converting cars over from one system to the next was that the R134A has a little bit less cooling capacity, than the R12. So typically cars that are designed from beginning of manufacture to use R134A have larger evaporators, the unit and the dash, to give a greater cooling capacity. So sometimes you may do this whole conversion and find that you really only have 75-80% of the max cooling that you had with the R12 system. The other problem is finding places like our particular shop, we don't have anything to deal with R12 anymore. I don't have any machines that can evacuate it. So it's that's the next challenge, is finding some place that can recover that, because you really don't want to just release that into the atmosphere.
Oh, for sure. There you go, Dennis. Thank you so much for calling. Jim Ward, our guest today, service manager at Smart Motors. Great to have him along, and thank you so much for listening. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn looks at the impact of increasing the minimum wage. That's at 2. Right now, talking about maintaining your vehicle, we've zeroed in a little on cooling and overheating, but certainly taking all kinds of questions with Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. Great to have him along, and thanks for listening. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Let's go to Darren in Green Bay. Darren, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question. I'm sure you've probably been asked it before, so I apologize in advance if it's redundant. But I've heard growing up, I guess, that from many different people that, running your air conditioning somehow reduces your fuel economy. And I'd always kind of dismissed it as hearsay, but was curious if there was any truth to that, or maybe only truth to that in older vehicles versus newer vehicles. But was just kind of curious, if it is a rumor, how that may have started or what.
Yeah, Darren, you set that up perfectly for Jim Ward.
That is an interesting question. It's a little bit different on older cars and newer cars, but it's certainly true that the air conditioning does require power from the engine. Older air conditioners were belt driven, meaning that they were driven right off the engine, and ultimately that does take power, and it does cost fuel economy. However, there are also, depending on the vehicle, there are comparisons. Modern vehicles that have electric compressors still require power. Some kind of charging system has to power that, and the engine has to supply that charging system. But those vehicles are computer managed a little bit differently, and they have different settings. You can put it on an eco setting, which means if you're accelerating kind of hard, that the computer is going to say, well, let's take a little power away from the air conditioner and give a little more power to the engine right now so that we don't affect that fuel economy, and the car's not going to suddenly have its temperature change from 10, 20, 30 seconds of acceleration. So it's better managed in newer cars, but typically the challenge has been, or the question has been, am I better off going 60 miles an hour down the road with the windows open or having the air conditioner on? And on modern cars, they certainly will tell you, and you can prove it out yourself, that there's more drag having the windows open, and it will affect your gas mileage more than having the windows shut and having the air conditioning on. But either way, either having more drag coefficient or more power from the engine running in air conditioning, it will affect fuel economy.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Darren. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Tim in Eau Claire next. Hi, Tim. Tim, are you there? We lose Tim? Sounding kind of funny. Let's try Jason. Jason in Menominee. Jason, hello.
Hi, how's it going? Hello, Larry and Jim.
Hi, Jason.
I'll make it quick. I'm somewhat mechanically inclined. I'm not necessarily a big car person, but I've always wanted a Jeep Wrangler, and I was born in 1981, so I want to get one of those, and I'm just wondering if you have an opinion whether you should discourage me or encourage me or
how do you want to use this, Jason? Do you want to run around on the weekends or here or there?
Yeah,
or do you,
I might get two of them. I might use one for four-wheeling and then one for driving myself
as your daily
my
driver.
Wife around.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, you know, I like you. You know, I've always admired those. They're a fun vehicle. I had a roommate one that had one and couldn't believe the things we did in that and didn't tip it over on Granddad's Bluff and Lacrosse. But you know, a couple things keep in mind. Those vehicles tend to be used a little bit differently than an average car because they can be, you know, because you can go places, which when I look at those, it's kind of like buying a hot rod or a sports car. You know, people rarely bought them and drove them tame. You know, they usually took them out to see how close they could get to the boundary of what you could do with that vehicle. So, you know, if you buy one, you may very well be looking at suspension upgrades or repairs on it. The drive lines, transmission and differentials would take some abuse on those things, but they're perfectly repairable. Parts are available for them. You're kind of mechanically inclined. You know, you can look at it a couple different ways. It's a lot of fun to get something that you buy old that's got a couple little problems, get them fixed up and take it out and have some fun with it. But the more fun you have, the more of that maintenance there's going to be. You know, I often in my own life, when I look at those things, it's like, yeah, I could rent one of those now and then. And I don't, but heck, that the hobby of working on a vehicle and doing that, it's not, there's plenty of information and plenty of parts and plenty of support and forums out there to get all the information you need to do what you probably want to do with that vehicle. So I certainly wouldn't discourage you. There's one from the year you were born. You probably meant to be together.
There you go.
Awesome.
Thanks, Jason. Appreciate the call. All right, Tom in Brookfield. Your turn now. Hi, Tom.
Hey, I got a 1990 Cadillac DeVille, and it's got a rough idle, only when it stops and it's not constant. It's very sporadic, and I'm kind of running out of stuff to replace. I changed the plugs, changed the TPS, changed the IAC, changed vacuum lines, and I'm pretty much only left with changing out the map sensor. I'm wondering, does that have any effect on idle? Everything I find online says, like, poor fuel mileage.
Right, right. And typically, I mean, that map sensor's got a range that it should operate and can be tested. There's a voltage test, and you can get depending on that car, you might have to look at it on a scope, but the mass sensor is not typically a symptom of that. You say it doesn't do it all the time, and so,
right.
You know,
it'll smooth, and then it'll just kind of, like, hiccup. It'll almost, like, miss almost as it's idling. It'll stop in gear.
But it doesn't set any codes. It doesn't turn on any warning lights when this happens. One thing that comes to mind, probably partly because we're talking about air conditioning so much today, but air conditioners, we were talking about fuel mileage on them, and air conditioners do put a load on an engine because of that. And an air conditioner, like the furnace in your house, doesn't run all the time. And in fact, it may run at times that you're not even expecting or thinking it's going to run, because on almost any car, anytime you have your ventilation control set over to defrost or defrost and floor, that air conditioner is automatically on in those settings to help defrost. And it doesn't run all the time, but when it does run, there's a device in the car that is supposed to increase the idle speed to compensate for it so that you don't feel this sudden, you know, drag down on the engine RPM. And that kind of idle up device You know, so is the kind of thing that they could give you kind of a rough idle when the air conditioner's on if it's not working. But, you know, the experiment would be to try intentionally turning the air conditioner on and off. If the symptom is clearly there when you turn the air conditioner on and not there when you have it off, that's certainly a place that I would look, because it sounds like you've gone through, you know, with the IAC, the idle air control valve and stuff, you've gone through the common things that typically would cause idle problems. But particularly an intermittent thing like that, that's one of the things that comes to mind here and pretty easy to test.
Then the other thing to make it even worse is that the compressor never turns on, because it must have a leak somewhere in the R12 system, like you guys were talking about before. And I was thinking about converting it, and I heard about it's not a foolproof way, and kind of shied away from that. So the compressor doesn't even kick on when I want it to. So I'm at a loss.
And it may still be putting some load on if it tries, but you'd be able to, you could still experiment with that. If you ask it to come on and see that idle go down, that is probably still related. If it makes no difference, then ultimately the throttle controls on that are probably the next place you got to start looking. But I don't think that MAF sensor is probably the source of your rough idle.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Thanks a lot for calling. And Ellen in Green Bay, let's go to you now. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, we have a 2011 GMC Terrain, and it uses probably about a quart of oil every couple thousand miles. I know we have 150,000 miles on it, but it started doing that at 30,000 miles. And because of that, it ruined a catalytic converter, and GMC stood behind it and replaced it. But we're still having trouble with burning oil. And if you don't have any other questions for me, I'll take the answer off the air.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would have other questions for you. That an engine that is using oil, all engines use oil to some degree, let's put it that way. And if an engine is using more than a quart in about 1,300 miles, it is eventually going to the varnishes and particulates that result from oil burning, because oil doesn't burn as clean as gas, are going to get into devices like the catalytic converter. It's a device that's in the exhaust system that's intended to clean up what's coming out of the engine that didn't combust with gas, but the oil is just too much for it. So that the rate of consumption you're describing is going to have long-term consequences like that. That oil is getting in the combustion chamber either through the valve seals from the top side of the cylinders, or it's getting past the rings. And as early as it started, I suspect it may be valve seals. Rings typically wouldn't have been worn by 30,000 miles on a vehicle, so you probably had a bad valve seal that's causing that. And ultimately, there are some procedures that you can do. Valve seals much easier than piston rings anyway, so that may be a repair that you want to look into, but it's certainly going to be a problem. The other thing to keep in mind with any vehicle that uses oil is that it sounds like you're familiar with what it uses. You've kind of got used to it, and you're probably checking it and adding it at a regular interval. And again, if it's less than a quart, 1,300 miles, the conventional wisdom is just check your oil and keep it full of oil. But an important thing to keep in mind is that rate of consumption you've gotten used to and could predict pretty well may change considerably if you take that vehicle on a highway trip. If you take off in a vehicle that uses oil, it may increase oil consumption on an extended trip, like driving here to the other side of Nebraska in one continuous run. It may go through 2 to 3 times the amount of oil in the same mileage. So obviously it's not great to have it burn oil, but that's usually more of a long-term concern. But it can become a very critical short-term concern on a trip like that if the oil level starts to go down much quicker than you expect. So something to be aware of there, that watch that on those trips. But yeah, without fixing that oil consumption, you're probably going to go through another converter.
Yeah.
Well, actually, we took a trip to North Dakota, and it didn't burn any oil, hardly, and it ran really good. But we are wondering if this is a problem with the Terrain. If you've heard that.
Well, I can't say that I've heard that's a big problem with those, but and that the fact that it didn't increase oil consumption on a long trip kind of supports the idea that it's probably more valve seals than it is piston rings. If it's piston rings and the lower half of the engine, the oil consumption usually does go up on long trips. Valve seals aren't quite as affected by the same way by that. you know, I can't say that I'm an expert on exactly what goes wrong in the engine and the terrain, but the symptoms you're describing do line up with what I would expect to be valve seals, and a couple of Google searches could probably tell you if most terrain owners are, or if many of them are experiencing that kind of a problem.
Yeah, we went online, and it seems like it is a problem, but I guess we'll just hang on to it till then.
Yeah, but I would check into what the repair costs, though. I mean, catalytic converters aren't cheap, and ultimately, you might find a shop somewhere that can do that as a reasonable repair and not have to go through replacing other components because of it.
I was thinking back to a new car. I bought a new Blazer about probably 25 years ago, and I immediately took it on a trip to northern Wisconsin, a 300-mile trip, and it started using oil immediately, and I wound up at the dealer in Hayward, Wisconsin, who said, well, you know, could have put a bunch of cans of oil in your car to carry with you on the way back. And I turned around and drove back, and they had forgotten to put the O-rings in.
Oh, goodness.
On one side of the car. So I think I went through a quart of oil about every, 50 miles on the way back. And
that's drinking it. Oh, my.
I got a new engine out of out of that deal. Oh, my goodness. Claude, this is bringing back a lot of memories here as we talk about all these different problems. Claude in Montello, it's your turn. Hi, Claude.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I have an 05 Trailblazer, and I disconnected the battery for a couple days, and everything was running fine. I turned the battery back on. I put the battery back on, sorry. I started the truck up. I went to turn the defroster motor on, and it died. So then I keep trying to figure out what the problem is. And I went online, looked, and did a bunch of things. They said, the only thing I haven't done is take it to a mechanic and have the computer reset.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some place I can get away with that? Is there?
Well, usually what is happening in that situation is that the throttle on a vehicle like that changes over time. It can get gummed up. And if we go back in history a little before modern throttle control systems, you would start to have physical symptoms you'd notice. But to get around that and make cars a little bit more able to react to gummed up throttles and changing throttle positions, they allowed the computer to adapt and learn what the throttle position is now, what the idle speed should be. So there's kind of a constant change so that you wouldn't have to do this servicing on the throttles as much as you used to. It might still get a little gummed up, but the computer's able to say, okay, well, this is where it's at now, and I'm going to make it idle at that same speed. But often, if the battery's disconnected, those learned values are lost.
Yep.
A lot of times, all it takes, I mean, it, the car may not start and idle on its own, but I suspect that you can, if you keep your foot on the throttle a little bit, that you can keep it running. You just have to have it a little more like 1,200 RPM. And driving it around that way, 10-15 minutes is often all it takes for that computer to relearn what the idle should be. Because, you know, it's true that a shop that can access manufacturer software could probably download some software in there, but it's still going to have to learn that idle anyway. And they could probably service your throttle and do some other. But in all likelihood, the car is going to need to be driven around and kind of, you know, hopefully do it in an area where there's not a lot of traffic and you can keep your foot on that throttle a little bit. If you come to some place you have to stop and just keep it running, and the computer should relearn the idle values and set up its own adaptivity again and idle just fine.
All right. Well, I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Tim in Eau Claire, on to you now. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
We do, Tim.
Okay. I got cut off last time. I have an 85 Ford van with 50,000 miles on, and I was in Colorado a month ago, and I could do okay when I got to the elevation of Boulder. I'm not sure what the elevation is, 5,400 feet maybe. But 2,000 feet up in the mountains, and it quit. The engine didn't quit, but I had no power going uphill. I had to back up into a parking spot, and then I coasted back down into Boulder. I looked around a lot, can't find any answers except from my two siblings. And we also had gas running out of the top of the tank that Although one mechanic said it's not coming from this vent, another mechanic says, yes, it does come from the vent. And as soon as I got back down 2,000 feet, got my power back, and the gas quit leaking. Can you help?
Well, you know, there's less oxygen, obviously, at higher altitudes. And at one time, cars didn't have any automatic adjustment for that. And there was a time when you had to adjust your carburetor and enrich the fuel mixture up if you were going to go driving in the mountains. Otherwise, you'd have your exact experience. That function is supposed to be an automatic function in modern vehicles, but obviously it's controlled by a number of components that tell a computer that we're at a different altitude, there's different pressures, there's less oxygen, and should richen up the fuel mixture. It sounds, though, like there's something more than that going on here, because that if that simply wasn't working in your vehicle, you wouldn't have anything related to fuel coming out of the tank. And the evaporative fuel system that's supposed to control the vapors off the tank sounds like it does have some kind of blockage, and that may be preventing fuel from being fed to the engine when you get to a critical altitude where you have to have a full fuel supply or a very rich mixture, or it's just not going to run. If we were just talking, if you didn't have the fuel leakage that you described, I would think we simply have a problem in the computer or sensor that helps control that fuel mixture at altitude. But I suspect that evaporative system problem is probably related. I can't say just how, but I would get that addressed first. They can test that vent. I mean, it sounds like you got differing opinions, but there are specific tests that can be done. There's equipment made just to test that kind of uses an inert smoke, kind of a fogging mist that it fills the system with, and they can check it for leaks, and they can check to see if the system has flow as it should between one part of the system and the next. It certainly sounds like that system's got a problem. I would start there.
Okay, what was that system called again?
It's called the evaporative emission system. The vapors that come off your fuel are not just allowed to vent off into the atmosphere. They're held in what's called a charcoal canister, and they're ultimately and eventually routed back up into the intake and burned with the gas that you burn. It shouldn't leak when you're at altitude, but if a vent is blocked, you can start to get those behaviors. And again, at altitude, the fuel system's got to be working perfectly, or you're really going to start to suffer from that lack of oxygen and the wrong fuel mixture.
Yeah, two things I didn't tell you was, one was the engine was starting to overheat, and this vent is a hose, I guess, that comes off the side of the tank. When I crawled under there, or when I just looked under there, it was running off into this maybe 8-inch long hose with a metal thing on the end. And one guy says, yeah, that's your air vent. That's a vent for the tank.
Well, it is an air vent, but it isn't quite as simple as that. There are valves that control when it purges and where that air goes under different circumstances. So the system, it doesn't sound like it's working right, but there sound like there is a number of things going on here. If the engine was overheating, if an engine gets hot enough, you may run out of power and the engine stop, having nothing to do with fuel controls. Boy, I tell you, that set of symptoms doesn't really fit to any one thing. I think you might have more than one problem going on here, and getting to the bottom of why it overheated and having that evaporative system tested are some basic kind of things that are not extremely complicated diagnostics, but I'd have that cooling system pressure checked and flow checked, and then that evaporative system tested as well to find out what's going on. I don't think this is just a single problem with all the symptoms you're describing.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Jim Ward, our guest today, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Talking vehicle maintenance issues today with Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And we will turn next to Barb in Nakusa. Hi, Barb.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I drive a 2009 Jeep Wrangler, and I deliver mail. And after it warms up, if I turn it off, I can't get it to go into drive. It'll take like anywhere from 2 minutes to 5 minutes before it'll finally shift into drive. It'll go into reverse, but just not drive. It only happens after it warms up.
And when it does go into gear, then is it just like nothing ever happened, or does it kind of slam into gear, or any harshness to it when it works?
It's it pretty much just goes in. It's a smooth transition. It just goes into gear.
Well, transmissions have temperature controls there's different ways they function, cold versus warm. And in transmission is electronically controlled transmission that's got some solenoids that control some of the shifting. It sounds like we've got an electronic problem going on here. When you first started to describe it not wanting to go into gear, we just had a vehicle in yesterday and it turned out it was a walnut. But that didn't go back into gear when it cooled down. That wasn't going to work again until the walnut was taken out. But you've got something, I suspect, electronically going on here with one of those solenoids. And usually there are tests. They don't necessarily have to take the transmission completely out and tear it down to diagnose that. The electrical parts of the transmission controls can be tested with it in the vehicle. And that's basically, a shop is going to need to see it while it's acting up. That's going to be the tricky part. If there's any predictivity to when it's going to do it, if you can get it to a shop and if you can time it in such a way that it's going to be acting up when they look at it, they should be able to run a few tests on some of those solenoids in a circuit to find out what is keeping it from going in gear.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it, Barb. Let's go to Pete in Wales next. Hi, Pete.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Jim?
Pete, how are you?
My daughter has a 97 Ford Escort, and approximately a week ago, the engine light came on, and I had my own code reader, which I did, and I replaced an EGR valve. After that, I took the code off, and I let her drive the car, and within 30, 40 miles, the code came back up, or the engine light came back up, and I put the code reader back on. It was the same code that came up, and I called a mechanic, and he said she has to drive that 100, 150 miles before that engine recalculates to take that code away. A couple of questions. After I work on a car and replace the appropriate part, should I automatically take the code off? And in this particular case, is he correct?
It usually does not take that long for a code for a computer to decide that the code's okay. The computer that monitors these systems typically uses what's called multi-trip or two-trip logic. Lots of fluky things happen in vehicle electrical systems, so the computer's often seeing a system or another computer or sensor throwing something at it that doesn't seem like it's in range. And if there's any other things going wrong, it typically the first time it sees it kind of just makes a note of it. The computer sets that, it doesn't turn the light on right away, but if in the next couple of drive cycles it sees it again, the light's coming on. Similarly, often these problems are intermittent, so they may start working right again, but the light's not going to shut off the first time the computer sees it. It's fine. In most vehicles, it takes about 15 miles to be a drive cycle of driving, and one or two drive cycles is usually enough once the condition's either corrected or, if it's intermittent, if it's working correctly again for the moment. If you drive a couple of drive cycles, usually it would shut off. Usually it would not take 150 miles, and typically when a shop does a repair on a device, if you've made a good firm diagnosis, you do erase that code because you really want to know if it's coming back again.
Right.
There are certain systems on vehicles, usually these are more safety related systems, that can have what are called permanent codes that you can't clear, and the computer won't clear it out until it sees that it hasn't occurred again in so many drive cycles. But that typically would not be related to an EGR system. That being said, I don't know if it's problematic to get a code for a given component and just replace that component. That's not how these diagnostics are really intended to work. There's probably a fault tracing procedure to be done to determine if that EGR valve was sticking or not, if it was working right, and it works in conjunction with some other components. I can think of a couple of different models of vehicles where they had an EGR valve problem, but when they came out with the countermeasure part, it wouldn't have been compatible with everything else, so you had to replace the intake manifold and had to reflash the computer with some new software. Now, I'm not that I don't believe is an issue on this particular vehicle, but you do want to go through some diagnostics. That I suspect the EGR valve itself wasn't the actual problem, that something else.
Yeah, the auto parts place that I went to get the part, I had them troubleshoot it, and they came up with a troubleshooting sheet, And I think there were four or five items. And the parts manager there said, I'd start with the EGR valve.
Right.
And
and it's a statistically great way to sell parts, you know, is to look at the likelihood chart. I mean, and, you know, your chances are pretty good because...
Expensive, yes.
I mean, but that is a model. I mean, and sometimes, you know, in fact, statistically, a lot of times you might come out better to go with those statistics, but those are just statistics. And I don't know about you, but I tend to end up being the black sheep when it comes to statistics. They just don't work out in my favor when I try those kind of things. So, you know, you probably don't need a lot of special equipment to test that particular system. You might just try doing a little Google searching yourself to see if you can find out what you've got to do to test the it's an exhaust gas recirculation system.
Okay.
It's a system that really is just supposed to help cool down the or change the combustion, cool it down a little bit, and help control some of the pollutants that get into exhaust from having a hotter combustion going on. But yeah, there's other things that work in conjunction, and you may have the vacuum or EGR modulator valve, something else on there that's actually sticking, and it's going to give you a code for that valve. But without the test, you're just going to be going down that line and taking the chances one component at a time.
A part that was mentioned that I'd never heard of was an EGR solenoid. Have you ever heard of one of those?
Yep, some vehicles use a solenoid, other vehicles, and it's basically an electrical switching valve as opposed to a vacuum switching valve. Some vehicles will use a vacuum switching valve. And again, either way, they can be tested. EGR works differently with a cold engine than a hot engine. So if you start seeing some tests that it looks like you can do, make sure that you understand the context of whether you're supposed to be testing it hot or cold.
Mm.
Very good. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thanks, Pete, for calling. Let's go to Daniel in Green Bay next. Daniel, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I bought a lot of cars that were near their end because I can do a little bit of work on them. But I bought this one car, and it had a rear window defroster on the windshield because the heater wasn't working so well.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you know of any place else that sells aftermarket rear window defrosters, because that one was, they were thick copper bands and big bulky things on the edge of the windshield that were glued on there and stuff, and it worked fine. I mean, it cut my defrosting time in the morning down very much because I parked my car outside, but it was ugly, you know, and I was wondering if you knew of any place that sold aftermarket rear window defrosters.
Well, they are sold. It's been years, but I once had a 76 Volkswagen van, and they're air-cooled. And if you ever drove one in Wisconsin in winter, you know, you need help. And so I had one that plugged into the lighter, basically to power a power jack, and it was a pretty neat size little unit. It really was maybe 10 inches by a couple inches, kind of wedge shape, fit right up in there by the windshield, and worked great. I cannot tell you a supply place right off the top of my head, but you know, that is certainly a device that's still out there. I probably have it in my garage somewhere, actually. It's certainly a device that is out there that you can buy that are far more modern than the bulky big heater windings that you're describing there.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually, you know, like the wires, like you see the thin wires on the back window.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But these were on the front window. These were on the windshield.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's less than ideal if they're having them. They're gluing them to the glass and attaching them to the glass. It may work, but you know, what I'm talking about is a little device. It's kind of a little forced air heater, but it's specifically made to defrost the windshield. And they're just slick. You can plug it into a lighter, put it up there. Of course, it takes electrical power to run it.
Yeah,
but those work great.
All right. Okay. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. And those little thin wires can break.
They can, and it's not, you know, even the basic defroster that's in the rear window of a car, and now a lot of cars have a couple of those lines up by the windshield wipers to help defrost right by the wipers there, but they're really essentially just painted usually on the inside of the glass, and so putting something like a box, shoving it back on that rear deck is often a cause for scratching, opening a couple of lines, and then when you see your defroster working, it's working on all but maybe two or three of those lines. They make little kits where you can kind of paint on a conductive paint. They work about half the time. That stuff doesn't like to stick to the glass real well. It's hard to duplicate their original installation. But and I've seen cars come from down south that didn't have rear defrost and had aftermarket ones put on. And you know, generally, if it's something they're putting right on the glass, I don't think it's worth that amount of work when you can just buy a little forced air unit that works very well.
Josh in Galesville, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
I got to replace my transmission gasket, and I've had a couple people tell me to try saving the transmission fluid and filtering it. Have you ever heard of that, or can I just use new?
You certainly can use new. I mean, if you had a gasket leak and there was nothing otherwise else wrong with the fluid, you could capture that fluid. I'm not sure what I would tell you to try to filter it with. The best bet is, if you know you're going to do that, to drain the fluid as clean as you can, just directly from the transmission. I mean, in other words, before you start the job, don't tear it apart full of fluid and have it just running all over the outside of the transmission case and picking up that dirt from the outside. But there really is no particular reason that you can't reuse the fluid. If it's clean and good fluid, yep, why invest in new?
The reason was because new fluid would change the viscosity, is what I was told.
Well, if you're using the right manufacturer's fluid, if it's the right fluid that's in there, that really shouldn't be the case.
So since it's a Ford, you'd suggest going with Motorcraft transmission fluid?
Yep, I'd strictly use what the manufacturer recommends, and Ford's kind of proprietary about their fluid, so I'd be careful about it. You know, one of the problems, this is probably an automatic transmission, most likely, and you don't want to cross-contaminate transmission fluids and mix different ones in there. They're not very tolerant to, you know, that kind of contamination from something. So, I would stick with the manufacturer recommendation for that vehicle.
Oh, okay, awesome. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Having a lot of fun today talking with our guest, Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors. He has over 10 years of master certification, and he's worked professionally with vehicles since 1978. You can join in. Got a couple of open lines for you. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your vehicle and maintaining your vehicle. We've talked cooling and overheating and all kinds of other things as well. So questions, join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at WPR.org or post at ideas@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Speaking of Facebook, Nanette on Facebook says air conditioning in her 2005 Dodge Caravan isn't very good. Wondering, she just had it fixed and it still doesn't do a great job. Wondering what might be going on. You may not have enough information to work on there.
Well, yeah, and it depends on what was fixed. You know, often when a vehicle comes in with an air conditioning that's not cooling, it turns out that the problem is a lack of refrigerant that we know leaked out somewhere, but a great percentage of the time, almost half the time, you charge it up and you take a look. This is a gas, keep in mind. It's not a liquid, and it operates under pressure. So if there's a big gross leak while you're charging it, you're not even going to be able to build pressure, and you're going to know right away that, in fact, when you first look at it, it may not have any vacuum. In a minority of the cases, but the majority of the cases, it still does have some charge, and the pressure is just low, and you charge it up, and you go through and check for leaks, and usually it's a visual check, and again, because you can't see the gas, you put a dye in it, and the dye stains the fitting or the component where the gas comes out.
Yeah.
They make little sniffers that are kind of like natural gas sniffers but you'll notice that if a gas company comes in or if you have some work done, they use that sniffer, but then they go back in to get soapy water and put it out, watch for bubbles, because those sniffers are notorious for giving false positives and not giving a positive when they should. So really it comes down most often to getting a visual look at it. So when an air conditioner is charged, when a leak is not specifically found and you just charge it back up with the refrigerant and put dye in it, usually the advice is given to come back in about 200-300 miles and let's take a look and see if we see a dye stain. So not knowing more history than this, I'm guessing that they didn't really find anything wrong except that being low on refrigerant, probably charged it up and hopefully put dye in it, and basically go back to that shop and they take a look. They are probably at this point going to be able to see a dye stain wherever the refrigerant came out. That's the most likely scenario for this.
Art wondered if you can buy those fans you were talking about before, if you could go in that go into the lighter, if you could buy those at like a bigger truck stop, for example.
You know, it's been back to the early 80s since I had that experience myself with the air-cooled vehicle that didn't have good defrost. But, you know, it's just, I know that people move around the country more and more in cars that are produced for down south, often don't have defrosters, and the vehicles are made for winter climates, have bigger heaters and charging systems and some differences. So there's still a market for that stuff. I personally haven't had to look for it or find one. I don't know if you'd find it at a truck stop. You know, it's pretty easy. Some of the larger truck stops, Lowe's, Road Rangers, and stuff like that will have websites. You can probably just about shop online out whether they have them. So I guess I'd start looking there rather than driving down the interstate and going truck stop to truck stop. I'd do a little bit of net research and see if you can find one.
John in Milwaukee, thanks for waiting, John. What's on your mind?
Hi, Jim. I've got a question. I got a 2012 Malibu, and one night he turned the car off and went to go start the car again and lock the doors, and the horn didn't beep when you press the remote for the lock. And when he started the car up, it ran real rough. So I changed the air cleaner on and stuff in the vacuum advance, and it ran fine. But then when he turned the car off again, it just clicked when he went to start the car again. So I changed the starter on it, the starter solenoid, and the car started up again, and then it started running rough. So I checked the jack, the advance, the hoses and stuff on, were on and correctly, and they were. It started running normal. Then all of a sudden, he has no power whatsoever. Brand new battery, no dome lights, no radio, no power going to the car at all. Now, I made sure that the cables were connected right, that the ground was connected good. Changed everything, changed the ignition module. The only thing I can think of, maybe the brain box might be going.
Well, it sounds like you don't have any real power to anything here.
Nothing. Power to nothing with a brand new battery.
A brain box is probably not worth starting. One of the things I wonder about, you mentioned you checked the ground, and we're talking about where the ground strap from the battery goes to the frame on the car.
It actually goes to the motor of the car.
Or if it goes to the motor, that's a lot. But the way, there's two different ways that ground, it makes contact on different vehicles. On some vehicles, there's a bolt that goes through kind of an O-type connector, a round-shaped connector, and the connector actually touching the surface of the block or the frame is what grounds on some styles. And other styles, it's the threads of the bolt that actually are what ground it. So, you know, you may want to take a second look at that ground. I mean, typically it's not a computer problem that would give us these kind of symptoms. It usually is something more with primary either, you know, and it's a strange set of symptoms you described on this vehicle and a strange set of repairs to have to do. If all those components really tested bad, you know, that sounds to me like we're losing ground. I mean, if those components were just replaced because we're going by a parts listing of statistical likelihoods, that's one thing. But if those parts all tested bad, a lot of electronic devices, I suspect that we're not getting ground somewhere.
Well, when it originally happened, he turned the vehicle off. Okay, he started the vehicle and he had called me over because it was running really rough. So I figured it was a vacuum advance or a dirty air cleaner or something like that. Like I said, when I cleaned the air cleaner out, it was pretty dirty and stuff. The car ran fine. And then he went to turn it off a couple hours later and it just clicked like you get a bad starter solenoid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I replaced the starter on it, and it's still clicking after that. So then I thought maybe it was the security system. So I put the ignition on for 10 minutes to change the security system back on again. And the car started right up right after I did that. But as soon as I could turn the car off, same thing again, just clicking. Like the vacuum advance door was just clicking. That's the only thing that we clicked on it. And since that stopped now, there's nothing after this now anymore.
Yeah.
Well, then this comes down to really, you know, having a schematic and some pen testing to find out you know, I couldn't rule out the security system. Can't really rule anything out. You've got to start doing some testing specifically to find out.
The check engine light did come on, but after I cleaned the air cleaner and stuff like that off, it all went off. That check engine light went back off again.
Keep in mind, too, if the light is off, it probably still has some code stored in the history, and they probably will give you a clue as to what was going on there originally as well. So even if the light's not on, I would still check to see if there's any historic codes recorded there.
Well, that's worth a look, for
that's
sure.
That's going to tell you where to start that pen testing for the wiring.
All right. There we go. Good luck, John. Appreciate your call. John and Nina, you're next. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Gentlemen, good afternoon. I have one comment. I don't mean to contradict. I'm just going with what Consumer Reports said about air conditioning and windows or not. And they said there was, especially with the more modern car, there is no drag anymore with the windows open And yes, definitely use reduced gas mileage when you run the air conditioning. That was their take on it.
Yeah.
My comment or question is, I'm wondering whose idea is it, and maybe I'm the only one notices it. I see it a lot of times on Interstate 41 when it's rainy or snowy or at dusk or dawn, people have their headlights on either automatically or they're on all the time. The problem is, I don't want to exaggerate, but I'll say 80% of the cars, at least, have no side markers and no taillights. This doesn't seem like a good idea. Who's in charge? Is that a government-mandated thing, or is it what the car companies do? It makes no sense to me.
It's a car manufacturer thing. Headlights have a mode that they didn't used to have called daytime running lights. And so a lot of cars, well, even if you haven't turned your headlights on, the bulbs are probably on, and typically daytime running lights will be about 70% the brightness of headlights. Some manufacturers will have taillights and side markers on with them, and some won't. And I have to agree with you that the problem is people get in their car, and if it's not extremely dark, or even if it is, it's very difficult for most people to tell the difference between 70% and 100% headlights. So they get on, it's dark out. If they were cognizant of it, they would probably turn their headlights on and think, gosh, I should have taillights behind me as well, and I would be able to see better. But because they see some light in front of them, they just believe that their headlights are on and don't realize it. But I agree with you. I tend to think, for safety's sake, that taillights should always be on with these systems. But of course, they're looking at how much power it takes and how quickly bulbs are going to burn out if you run all those bulbs. You know, I tend to have the same perspective you do. I'd prefer safety first.
Absolutely. Thank you, John. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And who knows how Consumer Reports tested
it. Yeah, I love controversy. And what I got to say is, get out there and test it yourself. Drive 10 miles with your windows open without the air, and then drive 10 miles with the air on the other way around. And, of course, you have to be exactly the same road conditions and the same wind and everything else exactly the same. But, you know, it's going to be different from one car to another.
That's just the way it is. Rick in Harshaw, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, Larry. Sure. I always enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And you too, Jim. I always enjoy this segment. I have a 2013 Nissan Frontier, and you mentioned getting a schematic and pinning it out. That's exactly what I like to do when I have problems. I went to the dealer and asked to buy a maintenance manual and schematic, and they said Nissan no longer provides that to consumers. Now, is that true in your estimate, or is that what, for instance, you work for Toyota? If I had a Toyota product, would you sell me a? In the past, I always had them, going back many, many years. They came in big bound paper volumes.
Now we can still get manuals, and ultimately, the one thing I will say is that technicians tend to use those printed electronic wiring diagrams less and less, and manufacturers are moving away from them. You can still get them from Toyotas, and part of the reason for that is that now a technician working on a vehicle can go to a schematic on a computer, and those schematics are interactive. So it isn't just a flat, you know, you can see what the components are, you can see wire colors, you know, and see certain values of components on the schematic. Now you can activate a circuit and see a little bit more illustratively how the circuit is supposed to work and what happens here when you do that for a normally working circuit. So increasingly, technicians are not looking at a paper wiring diagram, which you're used to using. They're looking at an interactive thing on a screen, and subsequently, manufacturers are seeing less demand for and using those less. Now, most manufacturers, you know, their information, they like to keep proprietary as much as possible, but almost any independent shop can, if they choose, subscribe to any manufacturer like Toyota's technical information system and get that information, although they're usually fairly costly annual subscriptions, so you probably have to work on a lot of cars. It's not practical for an individual to do that, but I'm afraid that's probably the wave of the future of manufacturers moving away from it. Over the years, there have been other companies, Bentley, you know, and a number of others, that Haynes, that make manuals. But again, they're more likely to have the paper schematics. You know, you may be able to find some information online. It's a hacker hobby to get out there and get information that's not supposed to be generally public and make it public. So increasingly, as much as manufacturers try to be proprietary, somebody will find that information and put it out there. But yeah, there's kind of a disturbing pattern of moving away from those kind of publications. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, well, thank you for telling me that. Yeah, I think it is a serving. In fact, I think it might be a consumer protection thing that should be. I mean, ultimately, you purchased the vehicle. It should be your, how should I put this?
You're right to have,
should have the right to have, yeah, the ability to get at that information. And, you,
yeah,
know, yeah, I mean, you know, it's, again, as a shop that, because as a Toyota dealer, they don't give me that prescription or that subscription either. I you know, got to pay for the equipment, got to pay for the subscription, and any other shop would too. So, you know, on the one hand, you know, I get it from the manufacturer's point of view, and there truly is a lesser demand for those things. You know, I don't know how much of it is really not wanting to allow the consumer to do those things, but, you know, I've always been a do-it-yourselfer, and it, you know, doesn't matter whether it's cars or anything else. You know,
right.
Typically it is becoming increasingly difficult with some types of appliances and some brands in particular to get that information. But it's out there.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, thank you. Yeah. And especially now in the age of electronic delivery, they could clearly, I mean, they could give you a manual and a wiring diagram, maybe not that interactive proprietary model, but something, unless they just don't produce it anymore.
Well, yeah, some manufacturers don't. They are moving away from it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Rick. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Joe in Rushville. Is it Idaho?
Indiana.
Sorry.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Joe.
Larry, you used to know me back in the 80s as Joe from Coleman.
Oh.
During Helen Harrison's show recently.
Yeah.
I moved back to my hometown in Indiana and listened to you online. First of all, J.C. Whitney for that rear window defroster, I bet.
Good idea.
Yeah, good idea.
They're online. I've got a 97 Jeep Grand Cherokee. And it won't switch from heater to mix to defrost. It stays on defrost. I'm wondering, is that a entirely vacuum run thing, or is that electronic? When it first started doing this, when it would flop to defrost, you'd hear a flapper do something.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd go to defrost when you were accelerating, especially hard acceleration. You'd let off the pedal, it would go back to heat or mid, you know, vent, whichever.
Yep.
So I'm just, and I don't hear any leaks.
And I don't think that's a vacuum operated system. I do believe that there is the switching mechanism, is that a radial switch that,
yes,
you turn back and forth? And I think that the problem on that has to do with the contacts in that switch. You know, there's a few different manufacturers, a couple Toyota models that use the switch like that. That typically, you know, as far as the manufacturer was concerned, there really wasn't a repair for it. You had to, unfortunately, it wasn't just the switch. You had to replace that. It was the whole module with the other heater controls in it as well. But I did have a tech that did.
I
had a tech that figured out a way to take that switch off and reroute the wire. Was connected to a contact in the back that it would make it move a little bit, and he routed it through the tube of the switch, which he could fix it. You know, it was a pretty big job, a couple, 2-3 hours to get it all apart, solder it, put it back together. But the modules were so expensive that it was still cheaper for people to do that. And, it, you know, I think that's probably what you're dealing with there. You know, it's not a simple do-it-yourself repair, but those are probably your alternatives, to either try to fix that one or have to replace that whole control head.
I wish I hadn't called now.
Yeah, don't always have good news. Don't always have good news. I wish you were hearing a hissing noise in the dash, and it was an older vacuum operator model. That'd be easy.
Hey, Larry, I do miss Wisconsin Breed of Public Television, or public radio. Which we've got good public radio. Where we are, we can get Cincinnati and Indianapolis both, but nobody has the local origination stuff like you guys do.
No, well, Joe, it's good to hear your voice again.
Oh, take care.
Yeah, take care. Thank you so much for calling. Oh, boy. That was nice to hear from Joe. Don in Madison, your turn. Hi, Don.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Larry.
Sure.
Hi. I've got a 2000 Chevy Impala with an issue when it gets wet, the wiring harness for the traction control and anti-lock brakes. Everything just kind of messes up when it happens.
Mm-hmm.
I checked on YouTube, and there were a couple of fixes that they showed, and I was just wondering how difficult it would be to replace that wiring harness myself.
I don't know if on that Impala model that Chevy did this, but most manufacturers originally had a long wire harness front to rear for all four wheels, and then started to realize that in certain climates that like to use certain products to get the ice off the road that we end up with a lot of corrosion that even though these are supposed to be sealed connectors, still tend to be prone to that stuff getting in there eventually. And I mean, it's with the B2 stuff, it's even worse. The stuff is more insidious to be able to get into those connectors. So most manufacturers started going to a little pigtail, a short little section of wire that went from just the last few inches or foot or so to each wheel. I cannot tell you if that model has that, but generally that is available for manufacturers to place that section of it. The problem is that once corrosion gets on those connectors, it is, in our experience in my shop, and what we see is it's kind of cancer-like. I mean, once those terminals are together, in other words, I could take a new wire harness, but if there was any corrosion, if you could see any blue or any sign of oxidizing on that speed sensor on the hub of that given wheel, if you put that wire harness on that connector, even if you clean them up good, 6-12 months later, you go back in there and they're all corroded again. And we eventually came to the conclusion, if we don't put the sensor and the pigtail, the wire harness on it, we're going to revisit this problem over and over again. You know, you could try putting dielectric grease on it and try different things to keep the corrosion from building up, but by and large, it's a problem of corrosive moisture getting in to a connector that should be water sealed. And so whatever you do want to try to seal it up, make sure the connector clicks in positively. But I have a feeling that if you don't do hopefully it isn't a whole wire harness you have to get, because those are real sensitive circuits, and it isn't a circuit that you can simply splice, you know, a couple of butt connectors in and still have it work the same way. So hopefully there is just a pigtail, a section of wire harness, but I would take a very, very careful look at the terminals on the sensor itself. And if you see corrosion there, you're probably going to want to do the sensor too, or you're probably going to be looking at doing the same wire harness with the sensor a few months to a year later.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it's that involved to get into it and take care of the problem. I mean, would you consider it to be or not?
It isn't. I mean, if you have to replace the sensors, that can be more of a job because they can be rusted in. They may not want to come out. There's usually a 10-millimeter bolt holding that onto a hub, and that, you know, that's not going to come out like the day it was built, if it's lived in Wisconsin all its life. But it's not an extremely difficult job. It's just as frustrating to think you got just a wire harness problem, put it on, it seems to work good, and a few months later then go back in and realize that, you know, that the sensor is now corroded. And I've seen the scenario play out where then you put the sensor in but thought that the new wire harness would be okay, but 6 months later find out corrosion's now built up on both of them, and you know, end up wishing you'd done them both at the same time.
All right, well, hey, thanks an awful lot. I really appreciate it.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. You know, we transport a lot more stuff in the summertime, bikes, canoes, campers. How do you tell how much your vehicle can tow or haul?
There is a little placard inside, either on the driver's door jamb or on the driver's door, that's got GVRW. It's got the gross vehicle weight, and then it's got another reading. I'm trying to think of what the acronym is, but it's a GVR. The larger number is the maximum weight. The one was the curb weight of the vehicle, and then the second one, the larger number, is the maximum weight that vehicle can haul, including all the passengers, everything you're going to load into it, the vehicle itself. And so you want to look at that placard before you load up and take off, particularly if you're towing something, because it'll also be rated for how much the vehicle can tow, including passengers and all the weight you're going to put in the vehicle plus what you're towing.
Well, Jim, I tell you what, it's always a pleasure to have you come by. I know we've got you scheduled for November 30th again.
And we won't be talking about summerization. We'll be summarizing winterization by that point. So.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here, Larry.
Jim Ward, our guest, he's the service manager at Smart Motors. Over 10 years of master certification. He's worked professionally with vehicles since 1978. Great to have him with us from Smart Motors of Madison. And thank you so much for listening. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll take a look at lawn alternatives with our guests from Old Brick Garden. So we'll look forward to that. And in the meantime, I hope you stay listening. There's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.